you know that you're loved whenever it's your last Sunday, and your friends ask if you would do your first preach on your last Sunday. So I'm very loved. And I want to tell you, I was in denial that I was preaching. I said, I'm not preaching, I'm just doing a little talk about a holiday. And then in the prayer meeting this morning, God said, no, but Sarah, it's a parable, and it is part of the preach, and it is my heart. And I said, okay, God, here we go. So I'd like to tell you a story. It covers about 400 years worth of history. So you can go ahead. So a long time ago, there was a group of people living in England that we've come to call the Pilgrims. And they were living under the Anglican Church, which was newly formed back in the early 1600s. And they disagreed with a lot of the theology of the Anglican Church. And they were seeking religious freedom. So a group of them got together. They left the UK. They went to the Netherlands, which had promised them freedom. And they spent a few years there. They weren't very happy. And they said, where are we going to go and what are we going to do? We really want to live how we feel the Bible tells us we should live. And so they went back to the UK, they talked with some powers that be, and they got permission from the government to found a colony in the New World, which was very, very new back in 1620. So they got a couple of ships together to start with, and they set off from the UK, and they had some problems with one of the ships, and I think it was called the Speedwell, and it didn't speed very well at all. And so then they had to consolidate themselves into a ship that looked much like this photo that you see here, which is a reproduction, called the Mayflower. Some of you may have heard of this in various history studies. There were 102 pilgrims that were on board, plus a crew of 30. They had one deck where they could live. That deck was about 150 square meters, so about the size of a good-sized two-bedroom flat in Johannesburg. And there were 132 people living in that space. And it wasn't just nice and steady, of course. It was a sailing ship on the North Atlantic, and it was rocking. Our family knows something about crossing the Atlantic. So they set off from Plymouth in the UK, and they sailed across the Atlantic. And the trip took them 66 days, which is a very long time to be living in such close quarters with so many people. There were no sanitary facilities. They had various livestock living with them. I smelled Greg's boat when he finished crossing the Atlantic, and it was vile. And I can't imagine how much worse this ship would have been. So they land in the New World in Cape Cod in Massachusetts, which is very near where I went to university. And so I'm kind of familiar with that part of the world. And they were part of this movement into colonialism. And in the early days, it wasn't about vast empires and things. It really was generally a few people seeking religious freedom and a few intrepid hunters that would sell pelts, which were very rich in the New World, which is very green and lush all along the eastern seaboard. So there'd been a colony founded, it was actually Roanoke, my apologies, my cousins, it wasn't Jamestown, that disappeared. Then they founded Jamestown in 1607, and then here come the Pilgrims in 1620. They have a lot to learn as they pursue hunting and farming and things of that sort. And the New World is settled throughout by Native American tribes. You can go ahead. So they land, and they land in November, so about now. But now is not springtime in Massachusetts. Now is the end of autumn and the start of winter. And so they land their ships, and they have no harvests. They're by and large not farmers, by the way. They're mostly tradesmen. So they have no crops. They are out of food. They don't know what plants they can eat or not eat. They don't know what animals that are good to hunt or not hunt. And they're in dire straits. And the only thing they have for shelter is that stinking little ship. So they send some men ashore, and the men build a common house as a start of their new settlement. And they make sure that they leave 20 men on shore to keep everything safe. Everyone else lives on the ship and keeps living on the ship in terrible quarters. The women don't really get off the ship because they're nervous for safety. So the men are on shore, they're trying to find things to eat. People naturally get sick. They don't have enough vitamin C, so they develop scurvy, they develop pneumonia, and all sorts of other diseases. And they have winter, and winter in New England is much harder than winter in the UK or in the Netherlands. There are blizzards, there's snow. I put a picture here because I think a lot of you don't know what snow is like. This is Boston, where I went to university, after a big snow. And you can see the cars that are buried on the side of the road. Obviously, that's not 1620, but just to give us in our modern life what it would look like if you woke up after a blizzard and found your car was completely buried by snow. So you can go ahead. So here they are, and they're in dire straits. They actually lose so many people that first winter. Over half of the people that had come over on the ship die. The ship had 18 adult women of the 102 that were on board. By the time the crops are planted, only 4 of these women are still left alive because the women stayed on the ship with the disease while the men went ashore to face the dangers there. So here's a miracle, and I love God's miracles, because they run into a man named Squanto. Squanto is a member of the Wampanoag tribe, and would you believe that he speaks English, of all things? Because this man, I know, it's crazy. This man had been captured by the English and taken over to Europe, and he'd lived in Europe for 5 years. Now, I love to bring exotic things from America over to my friends in South Africa, but I've never brought a Native American man, you know, to show off. That's not really appropriate, we know now, but here's this man that speaks English, and they're friendly. He and his tribe are friendly with the pilgrims, and they say, we'll help you. We'll show you what animals to hunt. We'll show you this crop that you have never seen because you're European. It's called corn, or maize, or a mealy, which is an indigenous crop in the Americas. And the pilgrims got to learn how to plant mealies, which they did in a little hole in the ground with a fish, because that makes good fertilizer. I learned that every year of primary school growing up. So they have this help, and with this help, they're able to plant crops, those that are left. They're able to build houses. They start to hunt the right kinds of game. They start to pick the right kinds of flowers, of plants and vegetables. And things are really looking good. And then they reap a harvest. And the Bible talks a lot about a harvest, but I can only imagine how glorious this harvest was in the natural for these guys living in a new world. So they're very devout Christians. And so then what they do, Ling, is they hold what they would have called a harvest festival and what we now refer to as the first Thanksgiving. And they invited the Wampanoag to come and join them. And they feasted, and they did a better job than I've ever done, even with my cousin's kind words. They had 3 days solid of feasting, of games, of sports. They would have had some turkeys, but people think that they probably would have had a lot of oysters and lobster, which is something that my son would like me to reinstate, but we haven't yet. So go ahead. So then Thanksgiving continues as a harvest festival, and it continues in small pockets in America, and sometimes it's a national holiday, and sometimes it's not, and people continue to celebrate this. And then there comes this neat lady, my namesake, I think. I love her, Sarah Josepha Hale. And as a young woman, she received a good education, which is much better than a lot of other women did. She got married, she had 5 little kids, and then her husband died. And in 18, whatever that was, 20, that was a pretty bad situation to find yourself in. As a woman, you couldn't go to work, but she did anyway. And she became a publisher, she became an author, and she wrote a very famous song that you will all know that goes, Mary Had a Little Lamb. And so she was quite, you know, a popular character in her own right, but she had a passion, and that passion was Thanksgiving. And she was part of a nation that was on a crash course to a devastating civil war. And she said, we must give thanks. We need to be thankful as a nation. We are falling apart and people are hating each other and brothers are arguing with brothers and we're on a crash course. And this lady wrote to her congressman and to the president, which is unheard of that a woman would do this. And she did this for 36 years. She was amazing. She said, we must have national Thanksgiving. And she kept right on writing. Because in 1861, which you'll notice 1861 is before she finished writing, the American Civil War broke out. And I don't know how much any of you know about it, but it was the most devastating war that the world had ever seen at that point in time. It was brother fighting brother, cousin against cousin. Most of you here have family in other provinces, and I'm sure if war broke out today with Western Province, KZN, Limpopo, that it would be traumatizing for your family. So the national mindset in 1861 is trauma. Because in my family, we had generals for the South, we had privates in the North. So we had this, and that's not interesting really in American history. It's perfectly common, is that families would have people on both sides. Sorry, I'm emotional today. But the war starts and it's bad. And the weapons technology has progressed so far that the strategy doesn't match, and people die by tens of thousands. The years progress, the casualties rock up, it's hundreds of thousands now. Things are bad. In June, July, there's the Battle of Gettysburg, which, as far as I can gather, statistics are not great, was the fifth bloodiest battle the world has ever seen, with 50,000 men killed in a single battle. So that happens in June. Sarah Josepha Hale, meanwhile, she's writing, "We must give thanks." What a crazy lady, hey? I love her. So she's crazy. She says, "We must give thanks." Things are so grim that in September, the US Congress gives a Congressional Medal of Honor for valor in battle to an 11-year-old boy. It's tremendous. And then October comes. Elaine? And one of my heroes, Abraham Lincoln, reads a letter from a crazy lady, and he decides that he's going to make a national holiday. And so he issues a proclamation that I'm going to ask Spence to read about Thanksgiving. And I just want you to think about, as Spencer reads this, about your circumstances, about the circumstances in our country, in our world. I want you to think about what the circumstances would have been in America, whenever Abraham Lincoln issued this proclamation. Things were terrible. They were really, really terrible. And this is what he had to say.
"The year that is drawing towards its close has been filled with the blessings of fruitful fields and healthful skies. To these bounties, which are so constantly enjoyed that we are prone to forget the source from which they come, others have been added, which are of so extraordinary a nature that they cannot fail to penetrate and soften even the heart which is habitually insensible to the ever-watchful providence of Almighty God. In the midst of a civil war of unequal magnitude and severity, which has sometimes seemed to foreign states to invite and provoke their aggression, peace has been preserved with all nations, order has been maintained, the laws have been respected and obeyed, and harmony has prevailed everywhere except in the theater of military conflict. While that theater has been greatly contracted by the advancing armies and navies of the Union, needful diversions of wealth and of strength from the fields of peaceful industry to the national defense have not arrested the plow, the shuttle, or the ship. The axe has enlarged the borders of our settlements, and the miners, as well as of iron and coal, as of the production of metals, have yielded even more abundantly than heretofore. Population has steadily increased, notwithstanding the waste that has been made in the camp, the siege, and the battlefield. And the country, rejoicing in the consciousness of augmented strength and vigor, is permitted to expect continuance of years with large increase of freedom. No human counsel hath devised, nor hath any mortal hand worked out these great things. They are the gracious gifts of the Most High God, who, while dealing with us in anger for our sins, hath nevertheless remembered mercy. It has seemed to me fit and proper that they should be solemnly, reverently, and gratefully acknowledged as with one heart and voice by the whole American people. I do, therefore, invite my fellow citizens in every part of the United States and also those who are at sea and those who are sojourning in foreign lands, to set apart and observe the last Thursday of November next as a day of thanksgiving and praise to our beneficent Father who dwelleth in the heavens. And I recommend to them that while offering up the ascriptions justly due to him for such singular deliverances and blessings, that they do so with humble penitence for national perverseness and disobedience, commend to his tender care all those who have become widows, orphans, mourners, or sufferers in this lamentable civil strife in which we are unavoidably engaged, and fervently implore the interposition of the Almighty Hand to heal the wounds of the nation and restore it as soon as may be consistent with the divine purposes to the full enjoyment of peace, harmony, tranquility, and union.
And Thanksgiving has been a national holiday ever since. And I'm with Kirst, I think it should be an international holiday. So to end that, I hope that you're all starting to feel a bit thankful. And I'd like to do an activity now, which is to make a little tree of thankfulness. I know we all share the same root in our Father, and I've made a jacaranda tree to make it South African. But I'd like to invite you all to come up. We're going to play some music, and then I've cut out little flowers. And if you could just write something that you're thankful for, and then glue it onto the tree, we'll have quite a beautiful picture whenever everyone is done. Thank you.
Because we have all these incredible children with us here this morning, first of all, thank you, worship team. Deep, beautiful spaces. Thank you, thank you. So I'm going to share a few thoughts on Thanksgiving for 10 minutes, and we're going to pray for some beautiful gifts in this community, and then we're going to feast, okay? So, because we have all these beautiful children with us here in the meeting now, Mila has gone to call her brother who disappeared a little while ago, but I'm going to start with a story from Narnia. And I'm going to speak to you about Thanksgiving from that story. So come sit, guys. There's going to be a story. Okay, so some of you might know the C.S. Lewis Tales of Narnia, but the last battle is about the last and evil days in Narnia. And there's this very evil ape and a very stupid donkey. And they trick many Narnians. And the children in the story end up being kept prisoner in a stable, like a dingy, dark little stable in which all the trickery is happening. And Aslan comes at this point in the story, and he actually completely transforms the stable. What was dark and dingy becomes a country in itself, a country of hills and grass and fruit trees. And the children are suddenly aware that everything has changed. But inside this world is a whole bunch of dwarves as well. And I'm going to tell you about how the dwarves were refused to be taken in. Lucy led the way, and soon they could all see the dwarves. They had a very odd look. They weren't strolling about or enjoying themselves, although the cords with which they had been tied seemed to have vanished. Nor were they laying down and having a rest. They were sitting very close together in a little circle, facing one another. They never looked around or took any notice of the humans until Lucy and Tyrion were almost near enough to touch them. Then the dwarves all cocked their heads as if they couldn't see anyone, but were listening hard and trying to guess by the sound what was happening. "Look out," said one of them in a surly voice. "Mind where you're going. Don't walk in our faces." "All right," said Eustace indignantly. "We're not blind. We've got eyes in our heads." "They must be darn good eyes if you can see in here," said the same dwarf whose name was Diggle. "In where?" asked Edmund. "Why, you bonehead, in here, of course," said Diggle, "in this pitch dark, pokey, smelly little hole of a stable." "Are you blind?" said Tyrion. "Ain't we all blind?" said the dwarves. "But it isn't dark, you poor stupid dwarves," said Lucy. "Can't you see? Look up, look around. Can't you see the sky and the trees and the flowers? Can't you see me?" "How in the name of all humbug can I see what ain't there? And how can I see you any more than you can see me in this pitch darkness?" "Oh, the poor things, this is dreadful," said Lucy. And then she had an idea. She stooped up and picked up some wild flowers, some wild violets. "Listen, dwarf," she said, "even if your eyes are wrong, perhaps your nose is all right. Can you smell that?" She leaned across and held the fresh, damp flowers to Diggle's ugly nose. But she had to jump back quickly in order to avoid a blow from his hard little fist. "None of that," he shouted. "How dare you? What do you mean by shoving a lot of filthy stable litter in my face? There was a thistle in that." "Earthman," said Tyrion. "She is the Queen Lucy, sent here by Aslan out of the deep past, and it is for her sake alone that I, Tyrion, your lawful king, do not cut off all your heads from your shoulders, twice proved traitors that you are, dwarves." "Well, if that doesn't beat everything," exclaimed Diggle. "How can you go on talking like that? Your wonderful lion didn't come and help you, did he?" "Thought not. And now, even now, when you've been beaten and shoved into this black hole, just the same as the rest of us, you're still at your old game, starting a new lie, trying to make us believe none of us are shut up and that it ain't dark and heaven knows what else." "There is no black hole, save in your own fancy, fool," cried Tyrion. "Come out of it." And leaning forward, he caught Diggle by the belt and hood and swung him right out of the circle of dwarves. But the moment Tyrion put him down, Diggle darted back to his place among the others, rubbing his nose and howling. "What did you do that for? Banging my face against the wall? You've nearly broken my nose." "Oh dear," said Lucy, "what are we to do with them?" "Let them alone," said Eustace. But as he spoke, the earth trembled. The sweet air grew suddenly sweeter. A brightness flashed behind them all. They turned. Tyrion at last turned last because he was afraid. There stood his heart's desire, huge and real, the golden lion Aslan himself. And already the others were kneeling in a circle around his forepaws and burying their hands and faces in his mane as he stooped his great head to touch them with his tongue. "Well done, last kings of Narnia," he said, "who stood firm in the darkest hour." "Aslan," said Lucy through her tears, "could you, would you do something for the dwarves?" "Dearest," said Aslan, "I will show you both what I can and what I cannot do." He came close to the dwarves and gave a low growl, low, and it set the air shaking. But the dwarves said to one another, "Hear that? That's the gang at the other end of the table. They're trying to frighten us. They do it with a machine of some sort. Don't take any notice. Don't listen to that." Aslan raised his head and shook his mane. Instantly, a glorious feast appeared on the dwarves' knees. Pies and tongues and pigeons and trifles and ices, and each dwarf had a goblet of good wine in his right hand. But it wasn't much use. They began eating and drinking greedily enough, but it was clear that they couldn't taste it properly. They thought they were eating and drinking only the sort of things you might find in a stable. One said he was trying to eat hay. Another said he'd got a bit of an old turnip. And a third said he was eating a raw cabbage leaf. They raised golden goblets of rich wine to their lips and said, "Ugh, fancy drinking dirty water out of a trough that a drunk donkey's been at. Never thought we'd come to this." But soon every dwarf began suspecting that another dwarf had found something nicer than himself. And they started grabbing and snatching and went on to quarreling until in a few minutes there was a free fight and all the good food was smeared on their faces and clothes or trodden underfoot. But when at last they sat down to nurse their black eyes and their bleeding noses, they said, "Well, at any rate, there's no humbug here. We haven't let anyone take us in. The dwarves are for the dwarves." "You see," said Aslan, "they will not let us help them. They have chosen cunning instead of belief. Their prison is only in their own minds, yet they are in that prison and so afraid of being taken in that they cannot be taken out. But come, children, I have other work for us to do." Guys, that's what thankfulness is. Thankfulness is the set of eyes that allows us to see the good gifts of the Father. Aslan is the picture of Jesus, right? To see the good gifts of Jesus, Holy Spirit, and Father. We can be blind to those incredible blessings and kindness and his faithfulness and love every day. Or, like Jesus says, we can allow the eyes of our bodies to be filled with wonder and belief in the goodness of God. And thankfulness helps to shift our perspective. Gratitude is the truth that breaks the lie of not enough, of disappointment, of fear and failure. There are thousands of good gifts every day that we get to receive from the Father, and thankfulness allows us to receive them. I've been spending some time in James 1, and I just want to read this quickly. "Consider it a sheer gift," or some versions say, "sheer joy, friends, when tests and challenges come at you from all sides. You know that under pressure, your faith life is forced out into the open and shows its true colors." Isn't that amazing? That we are surrounded by trials and challenges. And the biggest thing is that they want to suck us into their kind of gravity field. They want to suck us into worry, into that lie of not enough. I never have enough. There's so much lack in my life. We're sucked into fear and anxiety and hopelessness and despair. That's what those trials and challenges want to do. But James 1 says, our joy leads us triumphantly out. It's joy, it's a gift to be in those circumstances because it's in those moments under pressure that we actually get to recognize what we truly believe about the Father, about Jesus, about the Holy Spirit. If you go down a little bit, it tells you why you can have faith and hope in that moment. Because every desirable and beneficial gift comes out of heaven. The gifts are rivers of light, cascading down from the Father of light. There is nothing deceitful in God, nothing two-faced, nothing fickle. He brought us to life using the true word, showing us off as the crown of his creation. In those moments of pressure and trial and challenge every day, we get to choose to believe in the Father of lights because in him, there is no shadow. He's not giving us that hurt to teach us something. He's using that to bring out the goodness of who he is and who we have been created to be, the crown of his creation. So no matter where you are, I loved what Sarah and Spence shared this morning. In the middle of the Civil War, America's darkest moment, that was when they gave thanks. It's not in the moments where it's the victory moments and the success moments that we give thanks. Our worship is choosing to give thanks in the moments of trial and challenge, and that's where the real gold comes out. The real gifts are seen. So, joy, this word in James 1, joy leads us triumphantly out. Guys, joy is not something we have to fake. Joy comes when we recognize the good gifts of our Father, a amidst the challenges that we face. It's a supernatural joy. It's not a circumstantial joy. And so I want to give you this amazing illustration of Thanksgiving quickly. It's one that Jonathan Helser taught us. But friends of his sent 12 bottles of the most amazing wine to him, to them on their farm. And Amazon, I think it was Amazon, delivered the 12 bottles, and they weren't home when the bottles were delivered. And so the truck turned around and left with the amazing gift, and they didn't receive it in that moment. So they phoned the delivery company, and they made sure that next time they were home, so that when the 12 amazing bottles of wine came, they were there to open the door, take the little signing sheet, and sign for the delivery, and take ownership of those gifts that had been sent by their good friend. And that's what thankfulness is. It's actually deciding to take and receive the good gifts that the Father gives us every single day. And we can choose to not recognize them and not sign for them, and they literally pass us by on a daily basis. But if we stop and we take a moment for reflection and we sign for those gifts, we recognize the goodness and the faithfulness of our Father no matter what we are facing, no matter what place we're in. And it's so true for our country as well. In the moments of darkest challenge, we can stand and say, God, you have been faithful, and we thank you for your provision and your faithfulness and your goodness and every promise that would be fulfilled over this nation. We can get wrapped up in the busyness of every day. Hey, the demands, the urgent, they shout at us all the time. And it's the most beautiful practice to stop and be thankful for the simple things. I remember Rob and I were in bed one morning. It was early. My son generally wakes up before 6. And we were tired. And it was one of those moments where you just don't feel like facing the day. And Jude came in. And he was like, his face was all sleepy and he frowny. And then he had this little smile. And he came and he said, when I see you, I can't keep my smile down. And we were like, okay, come, let's start the day. And those are the little moments where you're like, oh God, I'm thankful for that boy. I'm thankful for my family. I'm thankful for my friends. And it shifts everything to, I don't have enough. This isn't good enough. I'm tired. Oh my word, my life is rich and full of the faithfulness of the Lord to us. I think that meditating on the simple things that you are thankful for, regularly practiced, can actually leave us in a state of complete contentment in God, that right now, here, I'm fully satisfied in the goodness of the Lord.